WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bernardo Bertolucci, the director of the films The Conformist, Last Tango in Paris, and The Last Emperor, has a new film called Stealing Beauty. Also, we talk with Marshall Frady about his new biography of Jesse Jackson. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new collections that are throwbacks to an earlier era. One features Rick Holstrom, the other Ronnie Dawson. And Marian Corrigan reviews Hellman and Hammett, a chronicle of the unconventional relationship between mystery writer Dashiell Hammett and playwright Lillian Hellman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The head of the Federal Aviation Administration admitted today that the agency reacted too slowly in dealing with problems created by rapidly growing airlines such as ValueJet. And Transportation Committee Chairman Bud Schuster, a Pennsylvania Republican, says the ValueJet situation has pointed out serious weaknesses in the agency.
The FAA has only recently discovered the extent of the problems at ValueJet. That being the case, then the question arises, where has the FAA been all this time? Why did it take a crash, 110 deaths, and an intense 30-day inspection, an intense media and congressional scrutiny to uncover these problems?
In testimony before the House panel today, Transportation Department Inspector General Mary Schiavo said the FAA's response to problems indicates that it's more concerned with the impact its decisions will have on the airline industry than with enforcing safety rules. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's ready to resume peace talks with the Palestinians, but he indicated there will be tough bargaining as he works to protect Israel's security. Netanyahu spoke after a meeting today with Secretary of State Warren Christopher in Jerusalem. Christopher said the U.S. position against terrorism is a strong one.
The enemies of peace still abound. Prime Minister and I resolved today in our discussion that those enemies of peace must not succeed. Instead, we must build for a future, a better future, to preserve and implement the agreements that have been reached with the Palestinians and with Jordan, and to try to achieve future agreements with Lebanon and Syria.
Christopher says he supports Netanyahu's position that there should be no preconditions for negotiations with the Arabs. Firefighters in Arizona are continuing to battle at least 9 wildfires. They say they're making progress on some of the blazes, but they've forced hundreds of people from their homes. Patty Urias of member station KNAU reports.
At least 28,000 acres have gone up in flames in the last 5 days, fueled by high winds and dry conditions since the first of the fires was sparked by lightning. While a handful of them continue to burn out of control, fire personnel have made some headway against at least 6 of the fires, which are nearly or fully contained. About 2,500 firefighters from Arizona and around the country are currently fighting the blazes. They will be joined by Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, a veteran firefighter, sometime today to help with the Hochtifer fire. It's the largest of all the northern Arizona fires, having consumed more than 12,000 acres of ponderosa pine so far. For National Public Radio, I'm Patty Urias in Flagstaff.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 14.5 points in active trading, and in the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down 5.5. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has ousted 7 army generals who were close to former Defense Minister Pavel Grachev. 4 of the 7 have been accused of trying to block Grachev's dismissal last week. Yeltsin has also signed a decree ordering Russian troops to start pulling out of Chechnya. Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski is scheduled to be arraigned today in Sacramento on charges relating to the string of mail bombings. It's Kaczynski's first California court appearance since a federal judge ordered him transferred from Montana last week. Linda Daly Paulson reports.
Tight security measures are in place for this afternoon's court appearance by Unabom suspect Ted Kaczynski. He appears before U.S. Magistrate Peter A. Nowinski in Sacramento to be arraigned on 10 federal charges. Kaczynski is the lone suspect in the series of 16 bombings, which resulted in 3 deaths and injured 23 over an 18-year period. Though interest in the case is high, seating in the courtroom will be limited. There are 45 seats allocated to the media, and that same number allocated for individuals who wish to view this portion of the legal proceedings. The federal trial is expected to start within 6 months to a year. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Daly Paulson in Sacramento.
President Clinton is declaring his support for a constitutional amendment to protect the rights of victims of crime during a ceremony at this hour in the White House Rose Garden. The concept is backed by members of Congress from both parties, as well as by GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole. There are victims' rights amendments in at least 20 state constitutions currently. A new General Accounting Office report finds a significant percentage of the nation's school buildings are in need of repair. A study says the problems are most widespread in major cities and in the western United States. 2/3 of the inner-city schools in the U.S. need to have plumbing, heating systems, or foundations replaced. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Ferrer, Straus & Giroux, publishers of Lush Life, a new biography about jazz legend Billy Strayhorn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Italian film director Bernardo Bertolucci. Two of his films from the early 70s moved him into the pantheon of great directors. The Conformist was a portrait of a man who has repressed all feeling and become a fascist. The Last Tango in Paris starred Marlon Brando and Maria Schneider as a couple engaged in a destructive game, having ferocious sex while trying to keep their anonymity. Very explicit for its time, the film was banned in Italy. Bertolucci's last three films, The Last Emperor, The Sheltering Sky, and Little Buddha, were shot on location in faraway places. For his new film, Stealing Beauty, he returned to Italy. The film stars Liv Tyler as Sarah, a beautiful 19-year-old American girl who goes to the lush countryside of Tuscany to summer with friends of her late mother. It is her ambition to lose her virginity during her stay, and everyone at the house where she's staying wants to recapture some of their youth by speculating about her deflowering. I asked Bertolucci to describe the idea behind the phrase stealing beauty.
When you are in Tuscany and you are shooting a close-up of Liv Tyler, in the background there is a hill, and my production designer comes back to me with a book and shows me that the same hill is in the painting of Simone Martini or Sassetta, fantastic painters of the Renaissance, of the Sienese painters, and you realize that everything is the same, the hill is the same, and that beauty has been stolen for centuries by artists, famous artists, and it has become like in a continuity. It represents a continuity of the art in that part of the world. So you find out that beauty is there to be stolen. So you have the beauty of Tuscany, the beauty of the landscape, and then you have the beauty of this American girl who goes for a few days of holidays in Tuscany, and she gets there as a young girl, and when she leaves, she will be a young woman. Something has happened to her. Her beauty, in some way, I mean, in a metaphorical sense, also has been stolen.
I think you're kind of critical of some of the middle-aged characters' obsessions with the young teenager who will lose her virginity while she's visiting them in Tuscany. But why is her virginity of such interest to you as the filmmaker?
I think that after having shot a movie of a quite big scale, like Last Emperor, Little Buddha, Sheltering Sky, I had two very strong feelings. One was to go back and shoot in Italy, and the other one to go back and shoot a little film, okay? A small movie like I used to do 15, 20 years ago. I wasn't even sure that I would have been able to do it as in fact happened. But I think that my desire to start a new phase in some way provoked the idea of the virgin, you know. There is something in this I was looking for something very fresh and without the big ambitions that my last movies had. You know, after having done Little Buddha, I was thinking, what's next? How far can I go in this kind of direction? What can I do next movie? Maybe God?
Right.
And I said, okay.
Charlton Heston's too old.
Yeah. And so I said, no, let's do a little intimate movie. Mm-hmm. Let's think that instead of conducting a big symphonic orchestra, I have a quartet or a little group of chamber music.
Now, this is perhaps one of the rare times in your films where the sexuality expressed, or at least the sexuality expressed at the end of the film, is kind of simple and tender. It's not sadistic, it's not masochistic, it's not manipulative, it's not about the use of power. It's very tender. And
it is. I think, I am a film director. My work is grabbing a camera and putting the camera in front of the reality. The reality is there, and I become a like of servant of the reality, because you cannot lie to the camera. So, in 1972, when I did Last Tango in Paris, the relationship between a young girl, Maria Schneider was 19, 20 at that time, and an older man, Marlon Brando, was based on what were the feelings, the values of that moment, okay? Between the two generations, for example, there was a great feeling of conflict, constant conflict. So their love story was fed by instinct of aggression and, as you said, aggressiveness, sadomasochism, etc. Also, I think that then, in 72 or around that moment, the idea of virginity was very, very different for the kids. I remember my friends, myself, thinking that virginity is something that you want to get rid as soon as possible. It's a little biological impediment of your freedom. You know, we were the myth. We all had the myth of freedom, freedom, freedom. Today is completely different. So, since, as I told you, I served the reality to be in my movie, the relationship between the two generations today is of reconciliation, kind of trying to understand each other. And also, the idea of virginity is something that kids are not so easy like they used to be in the past.
Now, speaking of reality, I always wonder if, in your mind, do you think that this couple, when losing their virginity, uses condoms or birth control, anything for either safe sex or birth control? Because it's not on screen.
If you could see me, I am smiling at the moment because somebody else gave a very good interview. At a certain moment said, can I make you one only remark? There is no idea of safe sex. You know my answer and my answer to you?
Yeah.
They were both virgin,
but
so they don't need.
But she doesn't know that about him.
But in fact, he is a virgin. He says, it's the first time for me. So maybe she doesn't know it, but she felt it.
Many of your films have dealt with sex, eroticism. I'm interested in why you've explored that so much in so many different ways in your movies.
I don't know, maybe because I'm a Freudian victim.
And, Freudian victim? Is that how you say it?
I've done more than 20 years of psychoanalysis. So, I said Freudian victim, as you say, fashion victim. And victim and also, how can I say, rescued from Freud. But, you know, for Sigmund Freud, sex is at the base of everything which is in the unconscious of every single human being. So maybe I think there has always been that focus on that thing because that thing helped us to understand a lot of other things which seem to be completely far from the idea of sex.
Does it ever put you as the director in an almost voyeuristic position, getting other people to do sexual things in front of your camera and having to encourage them to do it, even if they're perhaps a little uncomfortable or shy about it?
Stealing Beauty starts with a kind of declaration of voyeurism. You have a girl on an airplane first, then on a train, spied by the video 8 camera of somebody we don't see, with a kind of really peeping Tom, who's following her while she doesn't realize she's been filmed. And it's the beginning of the film. It means this movie's very much about that. You know, one of my fantasies was that the hole in the camera where you put your eye and you look at the shot is not very different from the keyhole of the of your parents' bedroom. I'm talking about...
Here comes Freud again.
Yeah, here comes Freud again. Like the primal scene that you have seen or you have not seen but imagined. I mean, there is a very strong voyeuristic element in cinema itself. Let's admit it. Let's say it. It's not something... I mean, really, the camera loop is like a keyhole. So... I don't see why it's more voyeuristic the eye who is filming a kind of sex scene than the eye which is filming a fight, a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why sex makes more voyeuristic. This is a bit, sorry, excuse me, but a bit of a cliche. I think that cinema is basically voyeuristic always. And it doesn't become more voyeuristic when it's about sex.
My guest is film director Bernardo Bertolucci. His new movie is called Stealing Beauty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with director Bernardo Bertolucci. Now, you called yourself a Freudian victim earlier in our discussion. You were in Freudian therapy for over 20 years, I think. Were you disillusioned by the end? Why did you stop?
I say victim in a sense of a bit, I mean, with some humor, with irony. Of course, I wanted to be a Freudian victim in the sense that I've been so long... in analysis that the word that came to my mind was victim. But I think that not only analysis helped me at the end of the 60s, when my movies were becoming, entering in a kind of the tunnel, that my movies were, maybe they were very well known now, but they didn't communicate. I mean, my problem was that I was feeling that my movies were kind of monologues, a kind of unique voice talking to whom? To itself. And at the end of the 60s, I started this Freudian analysis, and I loosened up very, very, very fast. And I did The Conformist, Last Tango in Paris, where I did my big step, my big jump between doing monologues, film monologues, to doing film dialogues. I was looking for a dialogue. So from the end of the 60s, I really felt the desire, even the need, of having somebody who was in some way reacting to what I was saying with my movies. And it was a big change, and it has been provoked by a certain sense of confidence that Mr. Dr. Freud gave me.
Is that what it was, a sense of confidence that you got that changed your movies?
A bit, yes. Because, you know, in the 60s, we were all, I say all because it was a little devastating group of young, very young directors from Italy, France, Brazil, Glauber Rocha, Canada, USA, Robert Kramer. I mean, there are fantastic names of really great artists of cinema. And we were all, how can I say, we were all terrified of the word commercial, that a movie could be commercial. Commercial was almost an insult for a film. And then I found out, I was one of the first one to find that out, in 69, 70, that all our rigor and severe attitude was because maybe we wanted an audience, but we were afraid of giving ourselves and not having a response. So I was afraid of not getting the answer from the audience. So it was better to close ourselves in a kind of ivory tower and do our movies for our friends and just for festival, and that's all. And also in the 60s, you know, the idea of pleasure was considered right wing.
You mean too bourgeois?
Too bourgeois. And then...
People are suffering, so who are you to have pleasure?
Very, very well. Exactly like that. But also, pleasure is immediately decadent and something really bourgeois. Finally, at the end of the 60s, one of the things I discovered that I could loosen up and I could enjoy the pleasure. Pleasure is not at all bourgeois. Pleasure is part... of life, of every single moment of life, and in the movies, for me, it's you know, I think that my movies, in some way, tell the audience, here I am, take me, I want to love you, I want to be loved.
A couple of your films have dealt with fascism, 1900, and The Conformist. You were a boy during World War II. Were you exposed to much of fascism when you were very young? Where were you during the war?
No, I was too young to be able to see the decline and end of fascism. I mean, my first memories are about German soldiers passing by the house of my family in the Apennine. But I really didn't experiment personally that period. That period, I know that period through what I heard as a child, through the stories we were hearing, and especially through cinema.
Right. Now, your father was a well-known Italian poet. What was life like for him during the war? Was he considered anti-fascist?
He was a teacher of history of art in a college in Parma.
So was he in trouble during the war?
So in 43 he heard that they would have soon come the choice were either you get involved with the army and go into the army, or you'll be taken to concentration camp. And the whole family moved to this little village on the Apennines, which is where his family is traditionally coming from, which was disconnected from the rest of the world because there were no roads. It was fantastic. It was like paradise. It was 3,000 feet height in chestnut trees in this beautiful landscape, very different from the Tuscan landscape of Stealing Beauty. Mm-hmm. But I remember we were going there, and the closest village was at 1 hour of walk, and they would come from our village with cows and with this basket to take us and to take our luggage. And there were no wheels because there were no roads, so the roads were made of stone. So instead of wheels, they were like ski. You know, and I love to think that I was spending my youth in a place where the wheel has not been invented yet. And so we recovered there, and we stayed for 1 year and a half hiding. My father especially, hiding in that place because he was in jeopardy. And then the end of the war came, 45, and we went back to the plane and to Parma, and... was the liberation.
Watching your father's life as a poet and then journalist, did you want to be in the world of literature or art yourself?
Oh, yes, of course. As soon as I was able to read and write, I started to write poems to imitate my father, you know. The son of a carpenter wants to work wood, and the son of a poet wants to be a poet. And, I mean, the imitation feeling is the first one. And but, you know, I will never be grateful enough to my father for a simple reason, that the way he introduced me to poetry. For me, poetry has never been something that you learn at school or is connected with the academic kind of dignity, let's say, or imposing. Or. To make you an example, which I think it's clear. When I was 7 or 8, he gave me a poet he just wrote called La Rosa Bianca, which means the white rose. He says in the poet, he's a poet dedicated to my mother, by the way. He says, "You are like the white rose in the bottom of the garden. The last bees of the summer have visited you," etc., etc., etc. I was reading the poem, and then I was springing out, running in the bottom of the garden, where the white rose was there. So he always been talking and writing about a very small microcosm, which was the house in the country, the house in the mountain, and that is his word. And so to see that the poetry was something related to something of the daily life was extraordinary. Take away any kind of, how do you say, of uptightness of poetry. The white rose was on the page, and the white rose, there it was in the bottom of the garden. They were the same rose. And so I started to understand that poetry is everywhere in the daily life. You can find it everywhere if only you are able to. And that has been an incredible lesson for me. It has been very important also for the way I do movies, you know.
How so? I want say more about that, about how that has inspired you as a filmmaker, the connection between daily life and the ordinary and the kind of poetry you would aim for in your movies.
Yeah, I mean, as I told you, I was writing poems for all my teenage. And when I was 18, 19, I started to think, but this is my father's kingdom. I don't want to intrude. Also, I will never be able to write poems as good as his poems. And I have to find my own expression, my own language. And I knew that the thing I loved was cinema, so I moved toward cinema. But I went to cinema from an experience as a poet. So I thought that doing a movie was like writing a poem. The camera was like a pen, and my first movies are very much influenced by the experience of the poet I used to be.
Bernardo Bertolucci, I only wish we had more time to talk. I thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Tari.
Bernardo Bertolucci directed the new film Stealing Beauty. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by rockers whose music is rooted in the 40s and 50s. We discuss Jesse Jackson with his biographer Marshall Frady. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book Hellman and Hammett. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two new collections, Rick Hallstrom's Look Out and Ronnie Dawson's Just Rockin' and Rollin', are throwbacks to an earlier era of rock music. Hallstrom's guitar instrumentals evoke the time in the late 40s when the blues was being used to forge rock and roll, while Dawson's music is filled with an array of prime 50s influences. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of both.
Rick Hallstrom, also known as L.A. Holmes, is a young white guitarist who, unlike many of his contemporaries, has leapfrogged the past. That is, his prime influences aren't Jimi Hendrix or Stevie Ray Vaughan, but bluesmen like Lightnin' Hopkins and T-Bone Walker. Hallstrom plays clear, crisp guitar lines that cut across the rhythm section like a sharp knife. His tone is so precise he often sounds as if he's talking through his guitar. If his album Look Out doesn't have anything on it that might be considered unique or groundbreaking, just the fact that he can revitalize older styles with such energy and humor makes him a valuable guy to have around right now. If Rick Hallstrom is a young fellow emulating his heroes, Ronnie Dawson, the blonde bomber, is a contemporary of many of those heroes who has never received his proper due. Dawson's new disc, Just Rockin' and Rollin', is head-in-the-sand throwback music at its best.
When you need money, you wanna be my friend.
Now 50 years old, Ronnie Dawson has been twanging his guitar for a long time. Born in Dallas, Texas, Dawson played the drums on Bruce Channel's 1962 hit, Hey Baby. On his own, he signed with Dick Clark's Swan Records and had some regional hits. But it's not difficult to hear why Dawson never hit it really big. His singing is highly derivative of Jerry Lee Lewis, and his melodies are smart steals from everyone from Gene Vincent to Fats Domino. But unlike many of his aging contemporaries, he hasn't turned into an oldies act cranking out music with exhausted mannerisms. He's still a real wild man on stage. Dawson also has a mean command of country music, as he proves on this devilishly pretty song, Veronica.
I'd raise the highest mountain, drain the seven seas, just to have you right here, honey, next to me. I'd lie and cheat and steal, get on my knees and kneel. Since you own my heart, I'd sell the rest of me. My Veronica, sweet Veronica, there's just nothing in the world I wouldn't do. My Veronica, sweet Veronica, I'm gonna make you love me like I love you.
Guys like Rick Holstrom and Ronnie Dawson don't have a chance on radio stations these days. But if the marketing label Alternative Rock had any real meaning, it would also encompass this sort of energetic, imaginative stuff. It can still really shake you up.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Look Out by Rick Holstrom on Blacktop and Ronnie Dawson's Just Rockin' and Rollin' on Upstart. That was Ronnie Dawson. Jesse Jackson's political career has been inspirational to many. One of the most visible and popular African Americans on the political scene, he grew up poor, rose quickly through the civil rights movement, and later became a presidential contender. His critics say he's more motivated by opportunism than larger social issues. My guest, Marshall Frady, has written a biography of Jackson. Frady is also the author of biographies of two other important figures who came from the South, George Wallace and Billy Graham. Frady first met Jackson during the Civil Rights Movement when Frady was a Newsweek correspondent in Atlanta. Frady is close in age to Jackson and grew up just 26 miles away from Jackson's hometown of Greenville. But Frady grew up in a white middle-class neighborhood. Jackson was from the area's poorest neighborhood. Frady started to write his biography in 1988, following Jackson as he campaigned for the presidency. Frady says that to understand Jesse Jackson, you have to understand the circumstances of his birth.
Well, he was born a multidimensional outsider to the main life of this country. In early 40s, in little South Carolina, middle town principally, of Greenville, not only black at that time of the American variation on our own variation on apartheid, not only black, but illegitimate. His mother was a teenage, unwed mother. He was unclaimed, unacknowledged by his natural father, who in fact lived with his own family just right next door. And so Jesse grew up watching, witnessing his natural father, who became a kind of almost mythic heroic figure to him, raising another household, a household in which from which Jesse was excluded. There were times, in fact, that Jesse would be glimpsed by Noah Robinson, his natural father, peering in the window of the house, a very handsome and expansive house. So it was almost, you know, a classic position of an outsider.
Your psychological reading of Jesse Jackson is that he really wanted a father figure, but his birth father shut him out and was unavailable to him, and that he sought that father figure in Martin Luther King.
Well, he found that father figure in Martin Luther King, and on a heroic scale, like his spirits, his own spirits, true and heroic father he found in King, and almost frantically, constantly besiege King with questions, ask him as if to inhale everything that King knew, and became an almost abjectly eager young attendant and apprentice to King, much to the irritation, in fact, of the other aides around King. But whenever Jesse was with King, he would just undertake to absolutely monopolize his time and his mind, and worshipped him. It was not the most serene relationship. King did spy in Jackson at that early age all of these huge gifts, but also vulnerabilities, more of a susceptibility perhaps to the sirens of consequence and celebrity and power.
How did Jackson try to find a place for himself within the civil rights movement and within American politics in general after King's assassination?
Now, Jesse stayed in SCLC for about 3.5 years. He had been appointed by King to head Operation Breadbasket, which was a kind of economic integration campaign in Chicago. And he and Jesse stayed in Breadbasket for about 2.5 years, but finally became terminally restless and formed his own movement, as it were, which he entitled Operation Push, those initials standing for People United to Save Humanity, which was only later changed to somewhat more temperate People United to Serve Humanity. But it was principally an economic militancy for economic equity. Also, the times were, there was not that great, clear, passionate moral pageantry of the civil rights movement that King, in a sense, had available to him. So it became a kind of, as so many of the efforts through the 70s were, a kind of interior, intramural, and not that dramatic, and not that conspicuous an effort, a campaign, as economic militancy. In the mid to the late 70s, though, he began a kind of school evangelism. It was in the inner city schools across the country, an apostleship to those kids for self-reliance and diligence and responsibility. Really, he was preaching to them the old Puritan virtues, the Puritan ethics, the McGuffey Rita fortitudes. So it was like a second. It was like a second phase in Jesse's progress and movement. And but finally, he phased and evolved into in compensation for not having the kind of theater, moral theater, that King had with the civil rights movement, into his political assertions and his political exertions, beginning massive voter registration campaigns through the South, and that finally phasing into his first presidential venture.
Your reading of Jesse Jackson is that he was born the consummate outsider, and through his political life, he's tried to become the insider. And one of the places he has tried to become an insider in is the Democratic Party, and he's never quite succeeded in doing that. Why not, do you think? Do you think is it a function of racism?
Certainly, to a degree, it's been a function of racism. But there has also been, there began to set in a determination among Democratic leadership after successive defeats, the Mondales and Dukakis's, to an obsession, it seemed, to mutate Democratic Party into some sort of alternative to what was assumed to be the Reaganite mood in the country, and to adapt to that. Someone like Jackson, not just simply that he's black, but representing as he did the old liberal conscience of the party, could not have posed to the party's leadership more mischievous possibilities, more vandalistic possibilities. So they're set in very early a determination to edit him and his constituency that he represented, at least to the margins of the party, so it would not figure. It was considered that if Jesse came to be identified as a central figure in the Democratic Party, it would, by the determination of these folks, would be fatal to the party's future.
My guest is Marshall Frady. He's written a new biography of Jesse Jackson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Marshall Frady, author of a new biography of Jesse Jackson. I imagine that not only hasn't Jesse Jackson ever received quite the recognition he wanted and acceptance he wanted within the Democratic Party, but that some of his stance have been quite controversial within the African-American community. For example, his stand on abortion, his stand on inclusion of gay rights in his agenda. How controversial has that been inside
both those positions that you mentioned have not come to him easily, and have not been that immediately, deeply, and you know, in his nature.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Let's start with abortion. Yeah,
abortion, as he still is of a very ambivalent, personally ambivalent mood and disposition on that question, as he has protested and can be heard, you know, until fairly recently, privately. You know, if that had been a real active choice for my mother, I wouldn't be here. I would not be here. And he has maintained that, you know, the right to choose, yeah, but the right to choose to do what? I mean, he is still arguing this out with himself in private talks. On gays, as he professed once, he said, man, that's a real tough one. Has been real tough to get next to. But there was a moment during the I forget whether it was the 88 or 84 campaign. I think it was the 88 campaign, speaking to a massive black congregation in Milwaukee, I believe it was. And when he began to make an appeal for compassion, Stanley Crouch recounted this in his coverage of that campaign this evening, that Jesse made the appeal to this mass audience. And as Crouch recollected, as Jesse talked about embracing this community, and particularly those who beginning to be blighted with AIDS, and including them in the general community, and embracing them, Crouch said that one could detect in that congregation, as he put it, that there was revulsion in the air. Jesse braved it anyway, and made this call nonetheless. This is just conjecture from coming to know him fairly well, but I have a feeling that he is more readily given to support gay rights than in fact abortion. But neither come to him naturally.
And how much do you think that has cost him, those stands?
I don't taking those stands.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I think he is bigger than those particular matters to the African American community. He has, I got to tell you, just become a folk figure, a folk hero, and remains a folk hero to Black America.
This, well, tell us a little bit about what it's like to travel around with him and the response that he gets.
Well, it's not unlike I would imagine traveling in the wake of a rock star. And, you know, one passes from one spontaneous popular combustion into another throughout the length of an 18-hour day. And but these receptions and, you know, these great roaring have a way of reviving him again and again and again. He breathes on these great ovations that he swims through, but it is in Robert Beckel, who was in fact Mondale's campaign manager and is now a political consultant in Washington, said that he had dropped by the Clinton White House not terribly long ago, and they were congratulating themselves, as Beckel describes it, on how they had managed to render Jackson a marginal figure. And as Beckel recounts it, he had advised them, well, if you think he's a marginal figure and if you think his day is past, just spend a couple of days with him when he is walking through inner cities of Cleveland or Columbus or New York or LA, Southside LA, or in some of these little outback communities in inner America. Just take a walk with him and see what kind of reception that he still attracts. It's just uncanny. I have not been a journalist for over 25 years, and to have not come across this kind of popular communion between a figure and the masses, a figure and the folk. I've come across this kind of in only two other figures, and otherwise wildly disparate, but they were George Wallace and then in his last campaign, Robert Kennedy. It is finally something that approaches the mystic.
And yet, Jesse Jackson seems to be trying to find a place for himself now in the larger political arena.
In those two presidential campaigns, though he fared far more impressively than either he or anyone else certainly reckoned that he would, they were still like diversions on what has always been his higher obsession, and he entered into those presidential campaigns as a means to what he considered to be a higher purpose. But faring as well as he did in them became, it struck me, somewhat beguiled and since by them, and bedazed, and since 1988 has seemed to be in a kind of suspension belonging to neither the world completely of his old movement ministry where his original aspirations had lain, and a political thrall, and has seemed to be pitching about for some large and meaningful front to engage, and it just owing, it, among other things, simply to the nature of the times, it is still not to be found. That scamper, kind of helter-skelter scamper of attentions and assertions has, particularly since 88, has begun to dismay many of his oldest and closest friends, and they fear with that scatter of attentions that he is beginning to devolve into triviality. But more than once in the past, he has flared forth from what seemed absolute terminal eclipse.
Marshall Frady, thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Marshall Frady is the author of a new biography of Jesse Jackson. There's also a new edition of Frady's 1968 biography of George Wallace. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Mystery writer Dashiell Hammett said of his longtime companion, playwright Lillian Hellman, that Lily is my right foot and I'm her left hand. As that quote suggests, they didn't quite fit together, but neither was one complete without the other. A new biography by Joan Mellon chronicles their unconventional 30-year relationship. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Hellman and Hammett.
It's taken me years to accept the fact that Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz didn't much resemble the lovable Ricardos. Now, after reading Joan Mellon's dual biography of Lillian Hellman and Dashiell Hammett, I've got to wean myself away from thinking of them as the real-life embodiments of Nick and Nora Charles, the boozy detective duo Hammett immortalized in his last novel, The Thin Man. Please, don't anybody write a warts-and-all biography of Eloise and Abelard, or I won't have any romantic illusions left. Granted, from reading other biographies, I already knew Hammett and Hellman were no angels. Hammett deserted his wife and their two daughters and wasted years drinking and having sex with every dame who appeared on his radar screen. Hellman, too, had her share of cocktails and sexual conquests. Additionally, she had a moral blind spot the size of Jupiter when it came to telling the truth, especially in memoirs like Julia and Scoundrel Time. But Mellon's biography, which is the first to draw upon heretofore restricted private papers, reveals secrets about Hellman's and Hammett's relationship sure to startle even the most hard-boiled fan of the pair. Mellon describes how early in their relationship, Hellman became pregnant. She and Hammett spoke of marriage, but then the emotionally elusive and sometimes physically abusive Hammett maneuvered events so that Hellman discovered him in bed with a prostitute. She subsequently aborted the pregnancy, and all marriage talk was quelled. During the McCarthy era, when Hammett courageously refused to name names and was subsequently thrown in federal prison, Hellman not only wouldn't put up his bail money, but fled to Europe. Like a good novel, every good biography has a strong theme, and Mellon's becomes apparent in her opening chapter, where she describes Hammett's and Hellman's meeting in 1930 in a Hollywood nightclub. According to Mellon, what the pair unconsciously began hammering out that first night was a Faustian bargain, in which Hammett, who was soon to fall victim to a 3-decades-long writing block, transferred his voice and style to Hellman, turning her into a tough she-Hammett. Because she could never wholly possess this initially faithless and later impotent Hammett, Hellman willingly became him, emulating his writing and his promiscuity. In binding herself to him this way, however, she gave up the chance for marriage and children, which she seems to have wanted. Who knows? Mellon certainly makes this psychological diagnosis of the Hellman-Hammett dynamic seem plausible, and yet one of the strengths of her engrossing and unavoidably depressing biography is that it reminds us that any deep relationship is so layered with ambiguities that solving it is an impossibility, a feat akin to locating the definitive whereabouts of the Maltese Falcon. Hellman thought of Hammett as the winner in their relationship, and he clearly emerges as the winner here. Mellon's Hammett is an attractive cipher, whose long silences and erratic bouts of honor contrast favorably with Hellman's insecurity over her plain looks and her self-serving, sometimes bullying lies. Were Hammett and Hellman somehow to be confronted with Mellon's unflinching version of their relationship, you get the sense that Hammett would shrug the biography off with a smile. Hellman would sue. I can't say I'd blame her.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hellman and Hammett by Joan Mellon. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.